So I want to say a little more about the teachings around the self that the Buddha pointed to many years ago. Because this teachings around the self and understanding who we are is often one of the more perplexing aspects of the Buddha's teaching on anatta, which literally means not self, understanding what is and what isn't self. This is from Mark Twain. He wrote, "Biographies are but the clothes and the buttons of the man. The biography of the man himself cannot be written, or the woman. Biographies are but the clothes and the buttons of the man. The biography of the person themselves cannot be written. So our words can point to who we are, but they also have a limitation." There's a line from actress Lily Tomlin, which I think speaks to this theme in a humorous way. She said, "I always wanted to be somebody, but I should have been more specific." We're always trying to be somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Wanting to be somebody. They look like Brad Pitt, looks like he has a nice life, or whoever we think, you know, we fantasize about has a nice life. So we live in this culture of, you know, I live in America now, so it's even more so, that the culture of the self, the culture of building up this personality and who we are and being famous and having 1,000 self-help books on the shelf and this culture of being somebody, supposed to be somebody interesting or important or special or funny or likable or something, right? Whatever this thing is we call me. Mark Twain again, he said, "We don't deal much with facts when we're contemplating ourselves. We don't deal much with facts when we're contemplating ourselves." A lot of ideas and thoughts. So I want to do two things today. One is to look at the teaching of the self, the teachings around self, selflessness, and how can we access this in our experience? How can we look at this? As I said earlier, the point is to encourage some exploration, not to take anything here, as I say, as dogma or as how it is, but just as like, let me see if this is relevant or true or appropriate, or let me explore, let me investigate, see what my experience is. In other words, that the attachment to the sense of self, whatever that is the biggest source of suffering. So it's a reason why I explore this, because that what we do with our identity, with our self-image, and how we try to protect and build that up and make something of it, and all of that, all of the things that we do around our identity, our personality, self-image, or however we understand all of that, creates a lot of angst, a lot of stress. As you all know, if you look to your own experience, your own life. This is from the New Yorker cartoon, New Yorker magazine. It's a cartoon, and there's a couple watching telly, and then there's the announcement from this game show. It says, "This week on The Amazing Race to Enlightenment, can Jim and Susie achieve right mindfulness? And will Barbara and Candy be eliminated for relentless clinging to the self?" So one day we'll have a reality Buddhist TV show with scorecards rating their mindfulness and the meditation and all that. So I'll bring in lots of different, things just to sort of shine light on this topic in both a light way and hopefully a useful way. So Time magazine, about 10 years ago now, they had a whole article, a whole issue on the self. Who are we in this exploration? And what does science come to understand? What does neuroscience and science come to understand about the brain and about finding who's behind who's pulling the wires, who's the puppeteer? who's thinking all the thoughts, who's directing the show. And the conclusion, and a lot of research on all the research that's out there, and the conclusion was, after more than a century of looking for it, brain researchers have long since concluded that there is no conceivable place for a self to be located in the physical brain, and it simply doesn't exist. That's Time magazine. That's some weird cult thing, you know. After more than a century of looking for it, brain researchers have long since concluded that there is no conceivable place for a self to be located in the physical brain, and that it simply doesn't exist. That it's a process. The brain, like our body and like everything else in this world, is a process. It's fluid, it's dynamic. There's no little center, no little nub in the center of the brain called me that's choosing and deciding, and it's a process, it's an ongoing process. Like we've explored today in the meditation, you know, sounds come, different reactions come, or they don't come, or liking it or not liking it. Thoughts come and go, sounds come, breath comes and goes. It's a fluid process that we ascribe more of a sense of solidity and realness to it than actually is. So if you think about your self-identity, who you take yourself to be in the moment, how many identities have you had this week? How many roles have you been in? You know, sometimes you're in the role of a parent, and that's your identity, you know, with your children, and it's a very, very real identity. But then maybe you go visit your parents, and you're suddenly the child. You know, or you go visit your relatives and you're a sibling. Or you go to work, and you're a teacher. Or you're a student. Or you're playing sport at the weekend and you're, you know, a lousy tennis player. You know, or the winner of a competition. And then suddenly that identity takes birth. So maybe you woke up this morning as the one who was grumpy and tired and depressed. You know, or lively and excited about the new day and doing meditation. You know. Well, who knows? And you see how it changes. It's fluid. Many, many different identities and everything in the moment seems so real, doesn't it? And it's like, you know, when you're angry, it's like, yeah, I'm really angry, that's all that exists. And then, you know, you realize you didn't miss the train after all, it's 2 hours late, and then, oh, it's peaceful, or really frustrated, you know. And it just keeps flowing, evolving, moving, shifting. So one of the challenges is we take all of these momentary identities. Not so momentary, sometimes they're more longer duration than that, thank you. As to be who we are. But are any of us who we actually are? Can we say I'm like this? Can we say I'm just a parent, or just a child, or just a teacher, or just a musician, or whatever it is you do, or into? Are they passing waves, thoughts, ideas, images, coming and going, created by conditions? So one of the easiest ways to understand this teaching is to see the Buddha said everything in this world, as we know, at least intellectually, is impermanent, is transient, is changing. Everything. There's not one thing in this universe that's not, you know, down to the molecular, atomic, subatomic, and quarks, and whatever the smallest thing is now, you know, to the macro, everything is in constant shift. It's light, movement, change, transience. And often the only thing that we think isn't changing is this sense of me. Whatever this sense of me is, it's sort of, you know, there's a feeling, there's a sense of constancy about, well, there's me. You know, in all, you know, I go to Regent's Park and I go home and I go on holiday to Spain and there I am. Wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, there's me. That's who I am. Whatever that is, right? There's a sense of self, right? Sense of, we feel it in the body. An image. When we're born, we're, according to development psychology, we don't have a self image. There's no self referencing at that point. We're in a more universal, merged place, usually primarily with mother, but also there's not a sense of a separate individual identity. And then at some point, 6 to 9 months, there's a growing sense of separation initially from primary caregiver. And then we start seeing we're related to as a separate identity. You're a person, your name is Bill. You've got your own room, your own clothes. You know, and that identity, that image that arises at such an early age, develops and deepens and entrenches over time. It becomes who we think we are. Good boy and bad, you know, whatever the story is about who we think we are. The Buddha said, the self of yesterday and that of today and that of tomorrow, for whose preservation you clamor, which is your true self? Self of yesterday, today, tomorrow? All of it? None of it? So the point isn't necessarily to take a position, but to really, you know, shake up the rug from this fixed idea of the mind's idea of who we think we are. Lighten it. So when you look at your pictures, and I just went to my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, so there's lots of pictures of, you know, from different eras. We look back and on our photographic history, and you see ourselves as a baby, and as an infant, and as a teenager, adult. Is it the same person? Is it the same person? Different person? Neither different nor the same? When you go to the hairdressers, get your hair cut, you know, and there's all this hair on the floor that you've so lovingly attended for so many months, and then suddenly on the floor, it's like, ew, you know, get that away, it's all, you know, yuck, you know. Or as I was doing yesterday, cutting my toenails. We take care of our body, right, so we take care of our toenails, and then we cut them off, like, ew, you know, get rid of toenails, you know. My sister shouts at me, like, cut my toenails in the presence. Like, gross. So, you know, it's part, you know, we'll say, yeah, you know, we take a lot of pride in our nails. Right? And then we cut them, and it's suddenly not who we are. But here it is who we are, part of who we are. It's part of identity, right? Our image and how we look and present to the world. The dust in your house, you know, when the light shines, and sometimes in the afternoon the dust, light shines and it reveals all the dust in the room, right? 70% of that is you. It's skin. You know, we shed our skin once a month. Where does it go? It goes in the atmosphere and on the clothes. And we don't say, oh, there's me in the clothes. It's okay. No, it's like, you know, it's, oh, God, you should clean the house, get rid of all that stuff. So it's this changing sense of identity and all the time. Humorous. So one of the places I notice this a lot is I spend a lot of time outdoors. I practice a lot outdoors. I teach a lot outdoors. And so often in where I live, there's a lot of great wilderness, and I'm often hiking alone. And there's a... As you probably notice, when you go outside, especially you go out into the countryside, and there's nobody around, and you're just, you know, really present to the environment, to the ocean, or to the trees, or the forest, and that sense of self that sense of self-consciousness usually relaxes, right? Because we're not around people that generate the self-consciousness, and we start to soften because the trees are just doing themselves, and wherever we are, and that sense of self relaxes. Or maybe we even forget ourselves for a moment, and we're just really present to the beauty and the smells, and then all of a sudden we hear some voices coming down the trail, or some mountain bikers or whatever they're doing, and suddenly there's the sense of self comes back, and maybe some fear or trepidation or curiosity, who are they, what do they want, how do I look, do I have my right outdoor gear on, do I look, you know, whatever I'm supposed to look, you know, and then they pass, and then we relax, and the sense of self seems to soften again. It's a really good indicator of how transient that is. Maybe that happens when you're home alone. Less so, because we've got all our stuff reminding us of, you know, projects and things and memories and histories. But to pay attention, so today pay attention to that transient sense of self. You know, sometimes we're sitting with just with our breath. We're just breathing, and there's nothing else. We're not even there's not even a me breathing, it's just breathing happening, breathing, awareness of awareness happening, sounds happening. Right? And then suddenly, God, did I send that email this morning? Shit, I really didn't. And the sense of, you know, our work identity comes back, and or the identity of the one who's always forgetting, or the worried one, the upset one, and then we're suddenly back, and notice how that feels. It feels contracted, it feels constricted, it feels tight. When that sense of self is softened or dissolved or not so apparent, there's a sense of relaxation and spaciousness. So that's an indication about why we're paying attention to this. Because when we're sort of caught up in ourselves and our anxieties and our worries and our fears, it's not that pleasant, is it? It's like it's stressful. And when we're more relaxed about that, there's a sense of ease. So one of the places I ask people to pay attention to this is when you first wake up in the morning. Usually when you first wake up in the morning, before the mind started kicking in with its to-do list and all the things you have to do before breakfast and, you know, before you get to work and blah, 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 there's a moment where you sort of wake up and you sometimes you don't know where you are. I often don't know where I am because I'm always traveling. I wake up and there's a sort of soft gaze. And then you look around, different bedroom. And there's a certain kind of sweetness because the egoic mind has not kicked into gear yet. It's sort of taken a holiday during the sleep. And you wake up and there's a moment of peacefulness. It's so present. And then, oh God, I got that meeting at 9 o'clock. I hate those meetings. It's Monday morning. And boom, the contraction, the solidification, tension is returned. And then the mind gets into gear and, you know, we're off and away we go. It's life. There's a poem I wanted to read about that very phenomena. When we wake up in the morning, see if I can find it in this mess of stuff. Maybe so, maybe no. Maybe yes. Dear Lord, so far it has been a good day. I haven't lost my temper, shouted at anyone, or forgot something. Amazingly, I have not told any lies, been conceited or selfish, nor have I done anybody any harm. I haven't smoked or even had a drink. Now, if you please, I must get on with my day, but first I must get out of bed this morning. So it's like that. So there's a beautiful poem, this Chinese poet Li Po, that speaks to this quality of the sense of self softening, dissolving in nature. He says, "The birds have vanished into the sky, and the last remaining clouds have faded away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. The birds have vanished into the sky, the last remaining clouds have faded away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. We get so quiet and so present that we just, there's not a sense of anybody looking anywhere, there's just presence, awareness." So I lost this poem and I was looking for it online, and you know how you go online and, you know, as they say, don't believe everything you read on the web. Well, here's a great example of it. So I find this poem, you know, and it's a Chinese poem, so it's translated in different ways. I particularly like that translation. But here's another translation which, well, I'll read it now. Give my 2 cents about it. "All the birds have flown up and gone. A lonely cloud floats leisurely by. We never tire of looking at each other, only the mountain and I." It's a very different sense, right? We never tire of looking at each other. Me and the mountain. Only the mountain and I. Right? It's a very different, it's a sense of solidity. It's me and the mountain. Which happens, you know, we look at the mountain, it happens, and, you know, but there's something else that's possible that these teachings are saying, pointing to. It's much freer than that. And I think the reason, and we'll do some walking meditation in a minute, well, the reason this happens out in nature more easily is because nature doesn't self itself like humans do. We're always selfing ourselves and selfing each other, right? Creating a sense of self and seeing one over there. But these, you know, these London planes are not saying, you know, I'm really better than those oak trees down there in the park. Like, I'm just really big and cool. No, they're just being trees. They're just being themselves, right? They're not, there's no ego out there. There's no selfing. It's just being what they're being. But, you know, we sit on the tube, you know, and there's a lot of people there, and there's this strong sense of self-consciousness and self-identity. Right? So that relaxes when we're outdoors. So that's why I really encourage people to go outside a lot. Even in London, the parks, the beautiful parks. I think when I was living in London for a long time, it saved me just going to Hampstead Heath every weekend, almost every day actually, at times, just to feel that sense of space and ease and relaxation. I think it was partly because of this, it allows this sense of self to soften, to disappear. This is a poem from Wendell Berry, a farmer and poet. He writes, "When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests his beauty on the water and where the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free." So I love this line, "I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief." How many forethoughts of grief do we have? You know, that we create and then we have a lot of stress about. As Mark Twain said, the worst moments in my life never actually happen. But we spend a lot of time worrying about them. The self, whatever we take the self to be, spends a lot of time catastrophizing. What if I get laid off? What if, you know, I lose my savings? What if, you know, I lose my partner? What if, you know, who knows? What if? A lot of thoughts about me and mine, usually. So, so the Buddha gave a teaching on one way of understanding the sense of self. I think this was a common teaching at the time that he was around, where, of course, there's now many more different ways of understanding who we are, but one of the teachings was this teaching on the five aggregates. Five skandhas are called in Sanskrit, which is a way of just understanding the different processes that make up who we are. Body, feelings, perceptions, mental processes, and consciousness. It's five different interrelated processes that is one way of understanding this thing called me, called I. In modern psychology, has a lot of different ways of understanding who we are. Different spiritual systems, Enneagram, all different ways we can understand our personality. But this is one classification, and it's a useful classification for meditation, contemplation. So maybe I'll just speak to the first piece of that, the body. And then we'll talk a little about the other ones later. Because the body is where we primarily take our reference for who we are. When we say, "Who are, you know, I'm Mark," we point, right? We point here. And this is who I am. I'm here, I'm alive. So that must be me. I must be here, present. There's a Sufi teacher, crazy wisdom teacher called Nasruddin. And so Nasruddin walks into a bank and he needs to cash a check. So he goes up to the cashier and she says, "Oh, I need to see some ID." So he starts fumbling around his pockets and he can't find anything and he pulls out a mirror and looks in the mirror and says, "Yep, that's me." That's what we do, look in the mirror, "That's me." Yeah. One thing that I love about doing wilderness retreats, which I do a lot, is we go away for a week or 2 weeks up in the mountains or somewhere in the desert, somewhere like that. And there's no mirrors, you know, unless you take one, which is pointless, my point of view. But you know, so you don't see, there's no self-reflection. Maybe in the mirror if you're, you know, a narcissist. And, and so there's not that external reference that we usually use strongly. And so, you know, there's just the sense of nature and whatever inner experience you have of yourself. And then you come back to wherever it is, you know, the airport or wherever you left your car. And you look in the mirror, it's like, it's so not what my inner experience is. It's almost like, who's that? Like, who's that scruff with a beard and, you know, which I am after 2 weeks being out there. And it's a really interesting reference point to not have looked in the mirror for a long time. And to see, it's like, oh, that's who I am. That's not who I am. Like, inner experience is so different than that appearance. So the question or the reflection to hold from this perspective is, you know, is to ask, is the body, is this who I am? Is this all of who I am? So just notice what happens when you ask that question. You know, if you cut your nails off or you lose your arm or your leg, or as people do in war and operations, I often think of that. What is it? The White Knight and the Monty Python. You know, the Holy Grail. He's fighting the Black Knight. Take off his arms and come back. Take off his leg. Come back. Take off his head. Come back. Who are we? If we lose all those things, you know, people do lose all their limbs. It happens. Is the sense of me and my arm? If I take my arm off, what happens to that? Is this really who I am? And the body is an amazing thing. But, you know, we sort of have a sense of ownership over it, you know. But it's really just doing its thing. And I'm going to read some statistics, which I love hearing about the body and how amazing it is. So we're each made up of roughly 100 trillion cells, which is a lot to keep track of. And if you unwound and joined the DNA from each of those cells, the DNA would fit into an ice cube, but if you put them end to end, the string would stretch 80 million miles. Isn't that amazing? 80 million miles. That's Earth to the Sun and back 400 times. I don't know who spent time measuring. You know. Amazing. I mean, what I most want to encourage is how concepts create a sense of staticness. You know, if we say, oh, I know what an oak tree is, right? We have a concept, oak tree. But if you stand next to an oak tree, the living, breathing, beautiful, gnarly, you know, you can never fully describe what the oak tree is. The words just don't come anywhere close to the mystery and the beauty of an oak tree, right? It's the same with ourselves. When we say, I'm Joe Bloggs, you know, 32 and a carpenter, is that who you are? It's like, no, that takes away the mystery of who you are. It stops us looking and being curious. So each one of us, and we also have our uniqueness. Right? It's not saying we don't exist. It's not saying we're not unique. Everyone's unique. Each one of us has a unique tongue print. However we would take our tongue print, I don't know, but we have a tongue print that's unique. While listening to this next sentence, 50,000 of your cells will die. But in the next sentence, 50,000 new ones will be created, all without you doing anything. It's amazing. No wonder you feel tired. Your body gives birth to 100 billion red blood cells every day. 100 billion blood cells. It's just phenomenal. All by itself. We shed 600,000 particles of skin every hour. I wonder if it's dusty. 105 pounds of skin in a lifetime. That's a lot of skin. It's heavy. It's heavier than half of you in the room, probably. What else? We make our liver, you know, if you don't like your liver, you get a new one every 6 weeks. Amazing. 6 weeks. Big thing. Cow's not as big. We replace our eyebrows every 3 to 5 months. We replace a head of hair, maybe a little less every time, but you know, every 2 to 5 years. So if you don't like who you were, you know, you get sick of yourself, there'll be a relatively new one at some point in the near future. And if all this gets you down, remember, it takes 17 muscles to smile and 43 to frown. 200,000 frowns creates one permanent brow line. So you can count how many frowns you've had. So here we have this mystery of the body that we inhabit. As one poet says, the body clothes that we take on for this lifetime. We don't get a choice about it. We don't have a catalogue before we come in and say, I'd like a tall one or a muscly one or a thin one. We just get what we get. You know, it's impersonal. And we personalize it, obviously, because this is where our awareness is located in the... It's not really located anywhere, but it's grounded in the body and the senses, which are located here, mostly. So if I say, bring awareness to your right foot, awareness doesn't live up here and go, oh, right foot, very interesting. No, it's awareness, it suffuses the body. Touch yourself. You know, there's awareness, immediacy awareness. But what happens is you'll notice, and we'll do this in the meditation, we'll see how we personalize many sensations. Like right now, as you're sitting, there are sensations happening in your body, right? Pressure, contact, warmth, sweat, heaviness, tiredness, all kinds of different things. Pain, aching, and the thought arises when we might be noticing a tingling in our bottom, and we note it, and then the thought comes up, oh, my backside is numb or aching, or my knees are hurting. Right? And this thought, my knee, my ankle, we personalize what is just a sensation from the perspective of awareness. It's just a sensation arising in the mind, in the awareness, simply coming and going. So when through mindfulness practice, the reference point becomes more awareness than what's arising. We see how things are coming and going, as it were, in awareness. So I want us to do some walking meditation in a minute. And I want you just to explore doing the walking meditation really with this sort of attitude of feeling the mystery of sensations that come and go in your attention. So as you take a footstep, right, you feel pressure and heaviness or density or movement as you move your legs, as the body sort of lifts a leg, sort of loses its balance, places. To pay attention to the kind of thoughts that arise, like my body, my walking, how's everybody else doing? Am I walking right? Am I walking like really spiritual? Do I look really cool? Does anybody notice? Does anybody care? You know, just all these different, identities and thoughts, self-referencing that comes up. And for the most part, just to simply be present to the experience of walking. Taking a step, taking another step, feeling the earth under your feet. If you can, take your shoes and socks off, walk on the grass. Just be present to this, to the body walking itself. We don't have to tell the body how to walk, right? The body does quite well. You'll probably notice you're looking at your feet, as if we need to do that to walk. No, just walk. Right, but normally we walk somewhat unconsciously. We have a destination. I'm going to catch the tube. I'm going to get to this event. And we don't even pay attention to our physical experience. Most of the time, we don't even notice we have a body. We live from the eyebrows upwards. We're mental, conceptual creatures. And every now and then the body hurts or something, or it's hungry, so we feed it. You know, we but we rarely even inhabit it. So, and if we don't inhabit it, as I said earlier, we're not going to be in the present, because the body is really the domain of the present. So we use walking meditation as a vehicle, as a support for taking this inner experience of mindful meditation that we develop in the meditation. We use that as a way to bring this quality of presence into an ordinary activity. We all walk, we all stand, most of us not very consciously most of the time. And it's a beautiful practice. Sometimes for some people sitting in meditation, it's either too sleepy, or it's too, not enough going on, and the walking is actually easier because it's more physical, more tangible. So you'll see, some of you will have more resonance than others. Since we're walking in Regent's Park and not some nice little retreat center where you can, there's going to be a lot going on. People, kids, who knows what you'll encounter. So obviously there's some awareness of your environment and cars and bicyclists and whatever else. But mostly keep the attention in your physical experience. Mostly in the legs and the feet, and the soles of the feet touching. And of course you're going to notice the sunlight and birds and people. And normally how we do this practice is we find a place, probably about the length of this room, 20, 30 steps, and we just simply walk up and down. So you're not taking a walk, you're not going anywhere, you're not going to explore Regent's Park, that's not what we're doing. We're doing mindful walking, which is simply being present to walking as you walk up and down. So it's just like, people pace up and down, walk normal pace, the pace feels comfortable. And just be present to walking. Walk 20, 30 steps, stop, turn around, walk back. You might feel self-conscious because it might look a little silly, that's okay. Just continue walking. When you space out, as you will, come back. Feel your body, feel your feet, look up and down, and then at some point we'll come back. Pay attention to the body. Notice when you space out and come back, and notice any sense of self, sense of identity, sense of self-consciousness. Sometimes walking makes us feel self-conscious. What's that feel like when you're self-conscious? If you're walking and suddenly trip, on a stone or something, you wobble, a sense of self-consciousness comes. What is that? What is self-consciousness? It's a really curious thing to pay attention to. You trip over in the street, a sense of, oh, did anybody see me? Did I look like really stupid? What is that? If you're out in the forest, that wouldn't happen. You just trip over and so what? So just be curious. But mostly just inhabit your body. Any questions about that? So it's now 12, so time flies.